Greetings, everybody. Hope your holidays are going well, and you've had a great Christmas and Hanukkah season. Getting ready for New Year's here in a couple days at the time of this taping of the Farm Bill Podcast. I'm Nick DeOlias, and episode 32, I think this is by far the toughest decision I've ever had to make when it comes to dedicating the episode to an athlete of note, because when you look at number 32, there is just a plethora of talent, epic talent to choose from. And you go across these different major sports. I started with baseball, and immediately my mind went to Steve Carlton, one of my favorite all-time pitchers, left-hander, right, with the Cardinals and Phillies, four-time Cy Young Award winner. One interesting statistic about Carlton, there was a year in the early 70s, I believe, with the Phillies, where the team was really bad, but Carlton was so good on a really bad team that he accounted at the end of the season for almost half, I think it was 46 or 47%, of the entire team's wins that season. So he had a really good pitcher on a really bad team. And I don't think I can ever remember a case where that was what occurred, where you had a single pitcher that was accounting for nearly 50% of the team's wins over a season. And the other thing about Carlton, besides his statistics and his accomplishments and strikeouts and wins and everything else, he was one of these truly eccentric individuals in professional sports, just a weird guy, whether dealing with the media or his views on things, his studying of different religions and approaches to life and philosophies, and then just how he lived and where he lived. So a definitely unique individual, which sort of makes things more interesting, to say the least. Then I jumped over to basketball when I was ready to settle on Carlton for the dedication. I thought, wow, 32 in basketball? That carries a lot of history with it. You got Magic Johnson, you got Karl Malone, and you got Kevin McHale, all from what I consider to be the golden era of the NBA. When I was growing up and watching pro basketball in the late 70s and through the 80s, and any three of those, right, would have been, I think, worthy people to dedicate the episode to. Magic Johnson speaks for himself, Karl Malone statistically over his career, and then Kevin McHale being a big Celtics fan, he was the cog of those great teams in the late 70s and early 80s, an awesome down-low player. And then with the hockey had, funny enough, not so much these giants of the game like you saw with Carlton or the NBA trio I just mentioned, but 32 in hockey carries with it sort of the title of villainry. You know, the villains in hockey that you think of, two that came to mind were Dale Hunter and his cheap shot after Pierre Turgeon scored a goal and basically hitting him and checking him into the boards, I think dislocating his shoulder and knocking him off of the playoffs that year. And then Claude Lemieux, the other Lemieux from Mario, Claude Lemieux and what he did with his hit on Chris Draper of the Red Wings when the Avalanche and Red Wings were going at it during a period where that rivalry was very intense. And then I jumped to football. And you think about 32 in football and running backs, Franco Harris, you know, from my beloved Steelers, and a Penn State alum, Hall of Famer, O.J. Simpson. I don't know if we'd ever dedicate an episode of the Far Middle to O.J. Simpson, but nevertheless, he did wear 32 and won the Heisman, had a pretty stellar career statistically. And then Marcus Allen, with what he did similarly at USC with a Heisman, and then what he did professionally throughout his career. But no, despite all those different awesome choices for dedication for episode number 32, I got to go with someone different, because this individual sits above just about everybody else in professional sports over the past 60, 70 years. And his name is Jim Brown. Jim Brown, when you think of how he approached his craft and what he was able to achieve in sports, he may be the purest of athletes ever in the history of professional sports and in American athletics. And the reason I say that is just, you know, people obviously associate him with football, but if you look at what else he was really accomplished at in the world of sports, it was pretty amazing. From a basketball perspective, he was an outstanding basketball player. He was a high school star when his family moved up to the New York City area and settled in Long Island. In fact, I believe that Brown set the Long Island points per game record for high school basketball players. And that record stood for a while until, and this is another interesting sort of juxtaposition of sports and statistics, there was a guy on Long Island that came along and broke Jim Brown's high school points per game record, and his name was Carl Yastrzemski. I didn't know that, but I just recently saw that he was a great basketball player and broke Jim Brown's high school record. Interesting. But then Jim Brown, and this is where I think many more people become familiar with him, he obviously went off to Syracuse, and yes, he was unbelievable on the gridiron, but everything else he did in athletics at Syracuse was sort of mind-blowing. He was a track star, ran to decathlon, or competed in decathlon, awesome at basketball as he was in high school and played basketball at Syracuse. And then when it comes to lacrosse, he probably is the greatest player in the history of American lacrosse. In fact, we talked in prior episodes, I think when we're talking about players like Mel Blount and those types of individual players where you see rules that are changed, Bob Gibson in pitching, I think we use that example. If rules are changed because a singular player is so good and so dominating at what they're doing, that is the sign of greatness for sure. And with Jim Brown, when he was playing lacrosse, at the time, you didn't have to keep the stick in constant motion when you had the ball. What you were able to do was basically hold the stick close to your body and run with the ball. Well, when Jim Brown did that, he was unstoppable. So the NCAA had to basically change the rules of lacrosse. And the reason you see players today playing lacrosse where they're constantly twirling a stick when they've got the ball is because of Jim Brown. And he basically changed the way lacrosse is played today. And then, of course, what he did at football at Syracuse speaks for itself. He goes into the NFL. And the bottom line with Jim Brown in the NFL, you can measure this a lot of different ways. But to me, I don't know if you've ever followed or read the books of the author George Plimpton, who was a big author in sort of the 50s, 60s, 70s, 60s and 70s predominantly. But he was sort of famous for inserting himself into an environment of a sports team or a sports event and then writing about it sort of as a person writing on it from the inside. So a novice, of course, in the sport itself, but you know, almost masquerading or pretending that he was the professional and then writing about his experience. And probably his most famous book along that line was Paper Lion, which is when he spent a training camp with the Detroit Lions. And in that book, and it's a great book, give it a read if you haven't, but he talks a lot about the players on the Lions and their views and respect, who they respected the most on other teams. And there were two players that really stood out in that book. One was Johnny Unitas. The players on the Lions had great respect for Johnny Unitas just because of his ability to win and just general or command a game. But the other player was Jim Brown. And it wasn't, I don't know if it was as much of respect for Jim Brown as it was for outright fear, especially, of course, on the defense. Nobody wanted to play him. Nobody wanted to try to tackle him. He led the league in rushing 8 of his 9 years. So he only played 9 years in the NFL. It was another great thing about Brown. When he was done, he was done. He left at the peak of his career, but he led the league 8 of those 9 years in rushing. Of course, he retired as the all-time rushing leader in terms of attempts and yards, also touchdowns. And he is the only player in the NFL to have averaged 100-plus yards per game in his career. I think he came in at 103 or 104 yards, somewhere in that neighborhood, yards per game, which is pretty impressive. But then beyond football, you know, Brown was an actor. My favorite movie of his was The Dirty Dozen. And when he was long retired, I guess in his 40s at the time, Franco Harris from the Steelers was inching up on his cumulative rushing record. And I don't think Jim Brown liked that. I don't think he personally cared for Franco's running style, which was very different than Jim Brown. Jim Brown ran over you, ran through you. Franco Harris was a little bit different in his running approach, and I'm a huge Franco Harris fan, of course. But Jim Brown didn't like that and probably didn't like the idea or the thought of his record being broken. So he had thoughts about coming back into the NFL to keep accumulating yardage to stop someone like Franco Harris or other rushers that were creeping up on him at the time. I guess Walter Payton wouldn't have been far behind to stop the record from being broken. He never did that, of course. But one thing he did do, I don't know if you guys, any of you remember this, he did challenge Franco Harris to a 40-yard dash on national TV, and they did hold the race, and Franco Harris won that race. And I think Jim Brown actually injured himself, pulled a hamstring maybe toward the end of the 40-yard dash, but I remember watching that as a little kid. You know, Jim Brown, too, beyond the athletics and the acting and that type of stuff, he was a what I would call a complicated guy. He was not a saint by any stretch of the imagination. He had numerous run-ins with the law over the years, much of it dealing with alleged or actual violence. So he had issues for sure. But on the flip side, you know, beyond the athletics, he was also very civically minded. He was buddies with Sam Cooke, the singer, And the two of them sort of took the view into their careers once they were established and very successful that, you know, for Sam Cooke, it wasn't another hit record. And for Jim Brown, it wasn't about the next touchdown. There was maybe some higher things that they were looking to achieve when it came to civil rights and things like that. So that was good to see on sort of the track record of Jim Brown. And he also did a lot of work in Los Angeles with youth, and specifically with gangs and trying to prevent gang violence. Put an awful lot of effort into that too, and probably saved a lot of lives. So, you know, Jim Brown, awesome athlete, probably or perhaps the greatest pure athlete that the United States has ever seen, outside of maybe Jim Thorpe and maybe a small handful of others. You can count them on one hand. And for that reason, coupled with his achievements and accomplishments, we're dedicating episode 32 of The Far Middle to him. Now let's make a short jump from Jim Brown and stay on the subject of football and the live experience of football versus the at-home experience. I recently attended a NFL game. It's the first one I'd been to in a number of years. I used to go quite regularly, but I gave that up a long time ago. And when I got there for this game, I immediately remembered why I gave that up for a significant period of time. It was cold that day, so you got to deal with the elements, if it's raining, stuff like that. The parking is always a mess around any NFL venue. Pittsburgh's no different. The traffic leaving, it just blows my mind that in 2021, going into 2022, We can be city government, it could be the NFL teams themselves. We can't figure out a way to get people that we know that are going to congregate in the same places 8 to 10 times a year. We can't devise a more efficient way to get them exited from those venues from a traffic perspective. It's just ridiculous how painful and wasteful that experience is. Always got to deal with the other fans, right, in the crowd. Alcohol is always going to be an issue there, and that can be a pain to say the least. And then the other thing about the live experience in NFL games, and probably for most sporting events live today, there's no more momentum. In other words, these games are broken up by TV timeouts and challenges on replays and all these different stops in the game, which just fundamentally kills the excitement of viewing it in person. You compare that to the at-home experience with HDTV and in the comfort of your living room or game room, doing what you want to do when you want to do it. To me, the two have never been wider apart, live versus at-home experience. And you got to think that the NFL realizes this, and they're sort of factoring that into their business plans moving forward. What I don't know is whether we're factoring this into our public policy plans moving forward. In other words, I've never been a big proponent of using public dollars and taxpayer dollars to fund things like sports stadiums, and specifically NFL stadiums, where, again, they're only used maybe a dozen times a year, a couple concerts, and then 8 to 10, if you count exhibition games, NFL games a year. Is that the best bang for our buck from a policy perspective, especially in this day and age with all the challenges facing society? I think we can definitely spend our taxpayer dollars much more effectively without having to subsidize NFL stadiums in the year 2021/2022. And something else that's been bothering me, and maybe it's a sign of me getting old, but the live attendance of sporting events or concerts, any sort of live venue, another thing that has changed and not for the better are the switch from physical tickets to these e-tickets or electronic tickets. I always, through my life, saved the tickets for events that I attended, and I'd pile them up and do different things with them in terms of displaying them, or they bring back memories. I mean, they're almost like photographs that you used to take from prior times in life. And it just reminds you of that game or that event or who you went with and what was going on in life, that type of thing. And I used to differentiate between the really good tickets and the really bad ones. And what I mean by that, some tickets, right, they had the perforation. So you went in and they tore the ticket stub. You could basically retain a intact ticket. Other tickets to other teams or venues, they just ripped them. And it was always interesting, depending on who was ripping the ticket, what you were left with. And then you look at that experience today and compare it to today. Now you've got these e-tickets and your e-wallets and your smartphones, and they're gone. There's really no way to basically preserve that. And it's very efficient, I suppose, from a transaction perspective. But you know, from a fan experience and sort of a takeaway value perspective, I feel it diminishes the overall experience, and probably over time, makes potential attendees less likely to attend these types of events. But that's been a peeve of mine Over the past number of years, as this evolution to electronic tickets has continued to grow to the point where it's the norm. We're never going back, of course, to physical tickets. And then jumping to the related issue of how professional sports leagues are evolving with their protocols when it comes to COVID and who plays and who doesn't play. New variants, of course, with COVID on the prowl out there. And then you see the NFL that is developing new testing protocols or instituting new testing protocols, which I think raises some really interesting questions. So to me, it's clear that the goal from the NFL's perspective is to keep games going. And the existing protocols when it came to COVID testing wasn't any longer allowing for that. So you have more and more players testing positive under the mandatory testing that the NFL instituted. And then you got, you know, slews of players being kicked out of games that were coming up. And then teams had to either delay the games, as we saw with the Browns and the Raiders recently, is one example. There were others, or, you know, having to completely disrupt schedule. And of course, that will disrupt revenues and TV following and TV ads and everything else. So the NFL basically changed the rules. And what did they do? They eliminated weekly testing for players that are vaccinated and who are not feeling sick. Now, is that following the science? I don't know, right? Or is that instead setting rules up so games can continue? Well, it definitely is going to help with that objective. So what's strange to me was to see what we know to be a very optically sensitive NFL, right? We've seen that through the past couple of years. They're optically sensitive, but now they're decreasing testing for COVID, not increasing it, when you've got those new variants, as I said, that are now on the scene. Interestingly, I agree with their approach. I think it's a very common sense approach. If you're vaccinated and you're asymptomatic, I wouldn't worry much about the testing of that individual. But I do disagree, or I do take exception to the lack of consistency, the inconsistency, and the alleged right allegiance to following science that the NFL constantly cloaks itself with. I think it's using... The NFL is using common sense basically to run their business model. And it's not about what they claim to be following the science or that type of thing. And it's certainly not consistent. But as situations change, I think businesses and individuals should evolve their behavior as well. Now, speaking of protocols for COVID, you know, our lockdowns that we have experienced across the nation over the past couple of years, that was all under the banner, right, of following the science that we mentioned earlier. I came across a really interesting article from two individuals from the American Institute for Economic Research. What these two individuals did was they went back and sort of gave you the history of where the scientific community's head was at when it came to lockdowns during pandemic, before COVID, and then where we ended up, and then why. Now, first, where we were before COVID hit. If you looked at the World Health Organization, WHO, in early 2019, so just before COVID, they looked at basically the efficacy, the effectiveness of large-scale home quarantines during a pandemic, and they did not recommend those types of large across-the-board quarantines because they found no obvious rationale or anything in the data that showed it would make the situation better. And you had Johns Hopkins also in 2019, a little bit after that WHO study, that looked at the similar type of an assessment. And what Johns Hopkins found was that when you're looking at things in the context of high-impact respiratory pathogens, something like COVID, right, quarantine is going to be the least likely to be effective in controlling the spread because of its high transmissibility. So Johns Hopkins was saying sort of later in 2019 that something like quarantine, it's not going to work that well. And then some of these entities and institutions also went back and did a lot of these studies looking at old data from, say, the 1920s with the Spanish flu pandemic. And they concluded that lockdowns didn't help at all, especially in urban areas or larger cities. Then what was really interesting with this, the prior thinking of our medical experts or the scientific community. So you had COVID hit in January of 2020, China is basically the first to go to a very harsh lockdown. Now, in January 2020, when China did that, our own Dr. Fauci, of all people, he questioned the move. And this is a quote from Dr. Fauci. Quote, "That's something that I don't think we could possibly do in the United States. I can't imagine shutting down New York or Los Angeles," end quote. Now, isn't that an ironic statement? And that was January of 2020 from Dr. Fauci. So what did, you know, we end up, how do we get to, if we thought that in the scientific view said that, you know, large-scale lockdowns, quarantining are not effective in these types of situations, how did we end up getting there? Well, in a word or a term, so to speak, the entity I think that was most to blame was the Imperial College London. They hastily put out this infamous study and model that said if you go to lockdowns across the board, you're going to save millions of lives across the globe. Everybody grabbed a hold of that. They ran with it. It became the new truth instantly. All this other sort of knowledge and cumulative experience went out the window. And what's interesting about the Imperial College London model, if you look at what it would predict when it came to dozens of nations or our 50 states, not a single country reached the predicted mortality rates of the unmitigated spread or even the mitigation model under this Imperial College London approach. And that mitigation model basically assumes social distancing and things like that. So horrible accuracy or predictability with respect to model results. Same with our states and countries when it came to, you know, connecting mortality to lockdown stringency. They didn't correlate. The more stringent the lockdown did not reduce mortality from a statistically relevance perspective. So that brings us to our third question, right? Well, if that's where the science was at before and up to the start of COVID, and then we took a 180-degree opposite approach of going with shutdowns because of, say, the justification of something like an academic model from Imperial College of London that had horrible predictability, why? Why do we do that? Well, I go back to that Johns Hopkins study from 2019, where they did note that some of these lockdown measures, such as travel restrictions and quarantining, they might be pursued for social or political purposes by political leaders rather than pursued because of public health evidence. In other words, you know, the political science may end up trumping the science. And I think we definitely saw a lot of that and experienced a lot of that when it came to managing pandemic. And we're just starting to begin to understand the magnitude of the collateral damage that might have been done as a result of it. And then, you know, following the science versus following the political science, we're seeing it rear its head once again as we close out 2021 and we're gearing up for 2022. I saw that a number of universities, and many of them, for some reason, I don't think it's happenstance, elite universities, Ivy League institutions, in the two that I saw, basically cut their fall semester short right smack in the middle of finals, barred visitors, sending everyone home, put all the exams to remote examinations instead of in person because of a new variant of COVID. And now you're seeing all these announced delays or starts of spring semester 22 at universities and them going back to the remote model. Now, again, if you follow the science, what do we know? We know that students across these universities, because of the mandates of vaccines, they're 97%+ of the student body is fully vaccinated. We also know that the new variant, although it spreads quickly, it's milder than prior versions of COVID. We know that these universities institute mask mandates. I don't know if masks make a difference or not, but you know they've got an additional protocol on top of it. And then who are your students demographically and typically? They're the younger who are the least at risk when it comes to something like a COVID type of a pandemic. So you got all these facts that are driving or should be driving your informed views on what you do with respect to in-person learning versus remote. Yet where do we land? We land with remote. And what's really disturbing about this, once again, this academia sort of culture of non-accountability, they're using something like a variant of COVID for political purposes to make political statements and optical statements instead of following the science that they're so proud of saying they cloak themselves around. But then on the flip side of their business model, when it comes to tuition and when it comes to charging students for the right to attend a university, none of that is being adjusted in any material way. So same tuition, same cost of the sort of service, but the service itself, they feel unilaterally able to drastically reduce the level of service with remote versus in person, just because they feel that politically it's the right thing, it's the popular thing to do. And we can take this issue of politics and political science, commandeering logic and science and math, right? We can jump to our next subject, which is When that happens, you also get things like the Build Back Better program that's being proposed by the Biden administration, because the Build Back Better program makes no sense across a range of different metrics that should matter greatly to our leaders. And that's been in the news a lot lately, right, with Senator Manchin. And when our process and our government works the way it's supposed to work when it comes to things like spending packages, you get what happened with the Build Back Better program. And now it's a bit on the ropes. Maybe it gets resurrected in early 2022. We'll see. But once the process of government worked the way it was supposed to work, what did you have? You had a bit of a meltdown from those on the left or the left's elite. And specifically referring to, of all people, Bette Midler, that I would never have expected to be talking about on a Far Middle podcast, but here we are, who basically threw a bit of a tantrum when Senator Manchin didn't agree to go along with the Build Back Better program as envisioned, at least currently. And she went to social media, basically referred to West Virginia as poor, illiterate, and strung out, which I found to be really disturbing. Because the people of West Virginia, and I've dealt with a lot of them, and I deal with a lot of them on a regular basis all my life, have been salt of the earth, greatest people you'd ever want to meet in your life. So you look at West Virginia, you look at what that state, the people in the state, what they do, specifically in energy as an industry of particular interest, what they do and what they provide to the rest of the country so that they can enjoy their quality of life, and specifically coastal elites. If you look at a lot of where the quality of life and energy comes from for coastal California and for the eastern coast of the United States, it's coming from places like West Virginia and Western Pennsylvania. It's coming from places like Utah and the like, and Wyoming, right, and Montana. And this indifference that goes right up to, and in fact with Bette Midler, crosses into the arrogance and the disdain that the elite have in this nation, especially the elite on the left, for what they reference as flyover country, is appalling. And to see it sort of manifest itself in something like a social media communication is shocking in the end of 2021 going into 2022. But you had it, and I think it just summed up a lot of why there's so much frustration out there from the middle class, from working poor, from flyover country, from certain industries like manufacturing and energy. And you saw it, I think, in shining form with what Bette Midler said when she was having a tough day because Senator Manchin was performing his duty as a representative to the people of West Virginia and the overall system of government that is the United States of America. And to be clear, I am not a proponent of the Build Back Better program. It makes no sense in the real world. So I know it sounds good, and you know it's a new economy that's going to create jobs for all Americans, and you know save the environment and all these other things that that it ascribes to do. But it just doesn't make any sense because it really leads to three things. It basically creates more government across every facet of the economy. That is going to stoke inflation. I mean, we've seen that front and center. It's so obvious. You're mugged with data that are unequivocal when it comes to how inflation is raging across every facet of our economy these days, and probably going to get much worse. It fuels deficits, right? So Build Back Better isn't going to cost nothing, as some of the proponents seem to want to warrant. It's going to cost an awful lot. And again, that's what's driving us toward the $30 trillion mark when it comes to federal debt. That is going to create a consequence at some point, and I believe that some point will be sooner than we think or than we want to believe. And then C, more government across every facet. It crowds out the private sector everywhere you see. And how's it crowd out the private sector? It distorts markets. When government becomes the biggest and most active buyer, transactor, et cetera, it crowds out the private sector consciously in many instances when you look at things like Fed policy. And it distorts those markets. That's why you get crazy asset valuations. And then that helps, again, stoke further inflation. So it's just this sort of non-virtuous cycle where more government, whether it's inflation, deficits, and the reckoning with deficits, or driving out the private sector via distorting the markets, it's just not going to work. It's the exact opposite thing that we need at this point in time. Thus, I am not a proponent or a fan by any stretch when it comes to the Build Back Better program. And whether, you know, whatever government intervention across our economy means, whether it's Build Back Better or the regulatory state or the Fed, speaking of the Fed, it sort of brought to mind the next sort of point to connect and dot to connect. Our Fed chairman, Powell, has finally sort of relented with the transitory tag for inflation. You know, he was instituting this transitory tag, saying the inflation we're experiencing, it is transitory. We're looking for a longer term. I think the phraseology he used was a inflation will leave a permanent mark on the economy, whatever that means. So he went from one vague term of transitory to yet another, even perhaps more vague term. But, you know, this idea of transitory, I think he was actually technically correct, because everything in life is transitory. It just depends on what extent of time you're talking about. He was making the point that when people hear transitory, they think short term. That's not necessarily true. Well, of course, I guess that's technically correct. So as I said, everything in life is going to be transitory. I mean, it just depends on how long you want that transition to take. World War II was transitory at some point. It might have been a small consolation or a little consolation if you were, you know, in some swamp on some Pacific island as a Marine, but it was transitory. This was going to pass. The Ice Age was transitory. The sun is going to be transitory. At some point, it's going to burn out. But when you look at the Fed's free money policy, and then you couple that with something like the Biden administration's Build Back Better program and this leftist agenda, this transitory inflation, or inflation that leaves a permanent mark on the economy, it may last longer or be much bigger than any of us had ever imagined. I hope you enjoyed episode 32 of the Far Middle. I did. You know, we started with some awesome athletes that wore that number through the years, landed on Jim Brown, the consummate athlete. When you look at what he's achieved over the course of his career, got into this issue of live sporting experience versus watching it at home and how that's changing and continuing to diverge in terms of the enjoyment scale. The tickets, how they've gone from hard copy, something you could take back with you after the experience, and now they're all e-tickets, and how I'm sort of lamenting that. We talked a lot about, right, the NFL and their evolving testing protocols when it comes to COVID. Is that following the science, or is that just basically changing your tactics so that you can still run your business model? I've got my suspicions it's more of the latter than the former, although I agree with the tactics and the evolution. I disagree, take exception to the lack of consistency. We got into the science of lockdowns. Very fascinating. Where the world scientific community was at before COVID, what all the data said, what all the experts said, Johns Hopkins, World Health, Dr. Fauci, basically saying lockdowns are not effective. Quarantining widespread is not effective when it comes to pandemic. And then suddenly, because of a single model from the Imperial College London, which has horrible predictability, horrible accuracy, everything changed. And now people felt free to use, quote unquote, following the science and all these lockdown policies and mandates to pursue political aims instead of looking after public health and what's best for the individual and life. Very, very disappointing, but very interesting at the same time. Universities, of course, academia, specifically elite academia, being one of the most guilty parties when it comes to this type of a thing. And you're seeing it again already with the close of the 2021 fall semester, with exams being cut short, going remote, and then 2022 already announcing remote learning, delayed starts to spring semester for no obvious scientific reason other than maybe wanting to make a political statement or following what's optically popular. We got into that issue of optics and popularity, political science versus reality with Build Back Better, and the disaster that we averted with the avoided passage of that because of someone like Senator Manchin, and how the elite and the leftist elites out there, like Bette Midler, basically take the good name of people like West Virginians and basically drag them through the mud because of frustration, and how it's just a great example of the disdain that a lot of the left and the elite left hold for flyover country and the middle class and people like the great citizens of West Virginia. And then we just talked about the optics versus the reality of Build Back Better, how Build Back Better makes no sense from a math, from a science, from a logic, economics perspective. It's just more government that stokes inflation, deficits, and the like. So I'm going to wish you a happy new year as we approach 2022. get geared up. 2022 is going to be really challenging, but I think there's a lot of opportunity and potential if we're focused and you drive hard. And until then, you can follow me on Twitter at Nick DeOlias. Check out the website, nickdeolias.com. Order a copy of Precipice, The Left's Campaign to Destroy America. Happy New Year, everybody. Talk to you with episode number 33 coming up at you shortly.